Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order. And it's 8:10 on March 24th. And first item, today's that we have a full agenda. We have four bills that we'll hear and lay over for future consideration. We will hear from the legislative auditor on the issue of costs associated with auditing the legacy funds, and we will complete our work on the legislative guide. The first item on the agenda is Representative Faust. Variable rate fertilizer application equipment grant program established, and clean water is the goal, and people are here for that. Would you please come up? Mr. Bond, you're the Executive Director of Minnesota Crop Production Retailer.
That's right, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here. We're at Representative Faust's request. I'm sure he'll be here any time. We, at his request, we have a PowerPoint that the Ag Finance Division heard. He asked us to bring the PowerPoint, and working with your staff, of course, we know you're very limited in your time, so we've reduced it substantially, but you do have in your packet handouts that cover the slide presentation that we provided to the Department of Ag, to the Ag Finance Division. In this presentation, we have two member firms represented, AGCO being one. Craig Jorgensen is representing him. Craig is to my left, immediate left, and then Paul Trichka. Paul is with CHS, or the old Senex, some of you know, and he is a certified production agronomist, and he is a professional agronomist, and he's here to really cover this in detail. We think it's a good public policy initiative, but we'll explain that.
Thank you very much. I didn't get Paul Trichka?
Trichka, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Would you spell that for me, please?
It's T as in Tango, R as in Ranger, C as in Charlie, K as in Kilo, and A as in Alpha. No vowels, only the last letter.
T-R-C-K-A.
And you have it on the screen behind you, Madam Chair, too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Welcome. And Representative Faust, when he was talking to me, he was quite excited about this, and it sounded like Mr. Bond was quite excited about this. And so please begin and keep in mind you have 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, welcome, Madam Chair and representatives. As Bill introduced myself, my name is Paul Trichka. I am a certified professional agronomist with CHS, Inc., and Bill has asked us, and Representative Faust has asked us, to be here to talk about what is production agriculture doing for the clean water part in the environment. When we talk about precision ag is part of the production ag. It deals precision ag, variable rate technology, and you also have, I believe you have these handouts with you too. So you were passed out a set of handouts. Now we're going to be flipping through some of these so you can look through them as at your leisure. Precision ag, variable rate technology, and it was a set of handouts that was up here in the material. And also site-specific applications are terms that are used interchangeably that you will hear in trade journals and things. Basically what they all do is we apply the right input in the right amount in the right place in the right place in the environment, and this is what this is doing is helping protect the environment. And we'll talk here just in a few minutes about how these things work. With any type of production, whether it's your garden plants, your lawn, crop, there are 16 essential nutrients that are required for a plant to survive. And what we're doing is we're supplying the macronutrients that are not provided by Mother Nature. So we have to come in there and supplement some of the places that and replace nutrients that have been taken up by the crop. Number one, we're looking at efficient use of energy and inputs. So production ag, precision agriculture, since fertilizers are generated by, you know, energy is the input, natural gas, things like that, we're becoming very efficient in its use and in, you know, requirement of that product. It also helps, what we're doing is we're reducing our ecological footprint. Number one, by looking at better crop production, we're increasing the organic matter in these different areas of the field. And I'll show a slide next looking at that. We're also taking a look by increasing the organic matter content, we're reducing or improving the carbon sequestration, basically tying up carbon, which is big in the news with global warming. So what we're doing is we're taking that crop residue, turning it into humus and into organic matter. So we're tying up more organic matter. This particular slide was some work that was done by the University of Minnesota by Dan Kaiser. And in this slide, they're looking at two different tests. They're comparing with sulfur and versus without. So basically what we're doing is we're taking the right nutrient and applying it in the right place. Now, if you look at the slide, either in the handout or on the overhead, you'll see the yellow areas. Those areas did not receive any sulfur. You can see how those areas, the crop is looking, it's pale yellow, it has a sulfur deficiency. The crop is not doing as well, so we're not building the organic matter. The other thing is, by building organic matter, we also help improve or reduce erosion control. By increasing that organic matter, that's one of the methods of, you know, reducing erosion is increasing the organic matter. So that's also part of this, putting the right nutrient in the right place. We're looking at also improving water quality. We are eager to be part of the solution rather than the problem. So that's what we're looking at, what we're doing here. Looking at this, again, from a long-term perspective and out in the future, precision ag, we're looking at the production ag, is keeping our land productive for future generations, people down the road, our sons and daughters and their farming down the road. Precision ag, because it does create, because it is a little bit more technical and it requires people a little bit more knowledgeable in what they're doing, it improves, it creates skilled jobs. And there's just a listing, a few of the skilled jobs that it does create at the local level in the local communities, you know, in the rural communities. We work with, when we make recommendations, these are just some of the factors that we work with for making these recommendations. We solicit, we sit down with the producers, and we assess a number of factors as far as what are we trying to obtain here, what is our objectives. This slide here is a comparison of the first slide on the left. This is a 200-acre field in southern Minnesota. And what we're looking at there, it's the year 2005 when this farm was soil tested. It's a 200-acre field. And if you see on the left side there, there's that notch that's cut out there. That's where the old building site or the building site was, where there was cattle and everything there. The green color there, the darker the green means, and this, we're testing for phosphorus here. This was grid soil sampled, so we take a sample about every 3 acres. The green area indicates that's, and the darker the green, very high phosphorus levels. And as we move away from the building site, the phosphorus levels drop off. And this was created from many, many years of, back 50 years ago, if you grew up on a farm, dad says, go get haul the manure out. Well, it probably went, you know, probably to the closest field right next to the building site. So that's why those areas have become that way. Through the use of the grid sampling, we've identified those areas that are testing high, being the dark green. The areas that are yellow are more medium testing. The areas that are red and orange are the low testing areas. So when the slide on the right looks at the application, so when we're looking at our recommendations for applying phosphorus for crop production, corn and soybeans, you can see that area that is testing very high, it's showing up as gray on the right side there, which is not receiving any phosphorus. So we're using the technology to reduce our application of phosphorus in those areas, which is going to help ultimately improve.
If I can just add a couple comments here.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Normally what would happen is a farmer would spread the same amount of fertilizer over the whole field. And so on the right chart there where you can see the gray areas, normally would maybe have 100 pounds of phosphorus applied there. And when the soils get that high, they have this phosphorus has a hard time attaching to the soil, and so it has to go someplace, and the only place it can go quite often is to run off into the groundwater or into a stream or something like that. So you know, that's a very important point that you notice that on places where it's very high, there's nothing being applied there so that because otherwise, if it is applied, it has nowhere to go.
Okay, thank you, Representative Faust. So,
Frischka.
Pardon?
Please, go on.
Okay, thank you. So this just shows what we're doing out there. Very similar to when if you test your home lawn for phosphorus, for soil nutrients, and if your soil tests are high, they're saying we don't need to apply any phosphorus on your lawns. Very similar situation. This slide here just compares the 2002 soil test versus the retest, which was done here this last summer. Now, as Representative Faust mentioned, that we're not applying any phosphorus out there. You can see there on the right side there, our phosphorus levels have dropped, which means that the crop has taken off the nutrients and our phosphorus levels are coming down. This slide here just takes a look at my colleague Kevin Anderson at Wadawan Farm Supply. We looked at just four quick examples of four different fields. The red bars showing what each field would have received as a flat rate application. The green bars is we're looking at if we're utilizing the precision ag or the variable rate technology, which resulted into a 15% reduction in nitrogen usage on that field without sacrificing yield. The other thing that precision ag, because we're using computers at these things, it records, you create a stamp of what was actually applied. So you have things for EQIP, nutrient management plans, and for crop safety. I'm going to turn it over to my associate here, Craig Jorgensen.
Mr. Jorgensen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently there is two major manufacturers of self-propelled variable rate equipment that can variably apply three products or more going through the field at one time. And it happens that both of those manufacturers reside in the state of Minnesota, one being AGCO Corporation, the other one is Case IH. The other major manufacturer for spinner boxes that have that capability as well is located in Iowa. And you see the three pictures here. The bottom picture there is from New Leader. They're located in Iowa. I did a comparison here of non-variable rate equipment versus variable rate equipment, just in the cost comparison of what it costs to a retailer. And the average cost from a non-VRT to a variable rate piece of equipment can be $60,000 to $90,000 in excess of what it would cost for them to buy a piece of equipment that was not capable of doing the variable rate applications. And then we look at a comparison of what the retailer is actually charging to the farmer for that different application compared to non-VRT applications. And you can see here for a pneumatic non-VRT application, they have a possibility of approximately $5,175 per day of income from that machine. But that same pneumatic machine now capable of doing variable rate can make maybe $5,600 a day. So there's not a huge increase in revenue per day, but as I mentioned, there was approximately $60,000 to $90,000 increase in cost to that retailer to get that piece of equipment. Besides that, there's also the added cost of adding more skilled employees onto their payroll and just a more laborsome type of a job. But we see it as something that really needs to move forward for us to improve that water quality. Here's an example of a machine. You can see it split into multiple bins. The machine's got the capability of varying the rates of each of those products. So, for example, each bin would receive one macronutrient product or micronutrient product, and as it goes across the field, it would know where and when to put the right product on and at what rate, all using global technology as well.
Can I add two seconds here. One other.
2 seconds.
Thank you. One other thing that this does is it will variable rate the chemicals as well. If you read the chemical labels, a lot of them call for a different rate depending on the soil type, so that a sandy soil will not get as much as a clay soil. And in the sandy soil, if you're putting on 2 quarts per acre across the whole field, the sandy soil, it's also, again, more likely to leach into the groundwater because it doesn't have the surface area of the soil to hold the chemicals there as well. So another advantage of this technology.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Jurgens.
Thank you, ma'am. Just in summary, variable rate applications of fertilizer, we feel, improve the crop yields, for one. They reduce the chance of water contamination by runoff, as Representative Faust said, because once your soil particles become so full of phosphorus, for example, they can't hold anymore, and it runs off to the water. It potentially can reduce the amount of fertilizer being used by the farmers and still maintaining or improving yields, and it helps the farmer become a better steward of the soil. Thank you.
So, thank you. Representative Faust, Mr. Jorgensen, Mr. Bond, Mr. Trishka, you're asking for $2 million from the Clean Water Fund. What's that $2 million going to buy us?
Very good question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for being late. My schedule said I was supposed to be
Let's
here.
Let's go.
Eight.
Let's go.
Okay. What it will do is it will be used as a rebate for the purchase price of the equipment. So if somebody spends $360,000 on one of these pieces of equipment, they would get 10% of that back. So it would cover not even all the additional cost of the variable rate technology that's on that machine, but it would cover at least a part of that.
And we would be paying the 10% so that we would have cleaner water?
That would be the goal, yes.
Would a farmer buy the equipment?
No, there wouldn't be farmers, at least not, I wouldn't believe there would be farmers large enough to purchase this type of equipment. Just about all of this equipment, and somebody would maybe know better than I, but I think all of the equipment that is currently being used in the state are by fertilizer dealers.
Madam Chair, approximately right
Mr.
now,
Mr. Jorgensen.
There is approximately 40 units like this sold in the state of Minnesota annually, and the way that this is set up for this bill is that they would have to custom apply at least 5,000 acres per year and be able to variably apply 3 products at the same time. So it does kind of limit down the number of people that it would fall into.
So, Representative Faust, you're asking us for $2 million from the Clean Water Fund so that your participants in the variable fertilizer applications can get 10% rebate back for something they're already doing.
Madam Chair, what the hope here or the goal is that we, instead of selling 40 machines, we'd sell 80 or 100 machines in a year, so that we would increase the amount of machines in the state so that a higher number of acres every year would be applied with variable rate technology instead of the traditional rate where we just custom apply the same fertilizer across the whole field. So our goal is to increase the number of these machines that are used across the state.
Thank you. Tell me the history of this bill in the process.
We've had one hearing in the Ag Finance Committee, and then it came to here.
It didn't go to Environment?
No.
Energy. All right, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles? Representative Wikinius. I guess. Thank you very much, Representative Venus.
I would like to move House File 3502 and for the possibility of being laid over for inclusion in your omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. A fiscal note is being passed out at this time, and a notation on the Clean Water Fund Reserve is being passed out. Oh.
Do you want to switch?
I would like to switch. Thank you, ma'am.
We have ample time to do this.
We're so flexible and fluid here. Mr. Nobles, thank you for coming and telling us about, earlier in the year we talked about audits of the legacy funds, and it was brought to our attention that there were some concerns, and so we thought we should hear about the concerns.
Madam Chair, Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, and I'm a little out of breath. I thought you would be going at a somewhat slower pace, but thanks for the call. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I think the problems have really been solved, and solved by the fact that there is now a bill which will be heard in the State Government Finance Committee this morning. And Representative Beard, who is Vice Chair of the Legislative Audit Commission, is the chief author of that bill. And the approach that we're taking is that we will be auditing. We have a responsibility, of course, to audit all four funds that are created under the Legacy Amendment. There is legislation, a law that was passed last year, that requires us to audit the Outdoor Heritage Fund every other year. And we would like to have that schedule for the other three funds as well. So what we are going to do is combine into our audit schedule two funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund and then probably the Parks and Trails Fund, and begin that audit work in 2011. And then the following year we would take the Clean Water Fund and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and then do the audit of those two funds, and then just continue on that cycle every other year doing the two funds. And so that's the way we would fulfill our responsibility. We are not asking for an appropriation from the general fund to do this. We will do it from our existing resources, and then the legislation will have the four funds reimburse us, the Office of Legislative Auditor, by us submitting to the Commissioner of the Department of Management and Budget the hours that we expend on that audit work. And so it will be simply on a cost basis that the four funds will reimburse us and basically the general fund for that audit work. So that's the plan, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Nobles, has there been discussion with the people that are involved with the finances of the funds on that issue?
Certainly, Madam Chair, with Mr. Becker, and I'm not quite sure exactly on the other three funds who we would be having that discussion with. Obviously, we've discussed it with legislators, with you and others, but since there is not a single entity, as there is with the Lessard Council, for the other three funds, I mean, our approach will be that we will mostly go to the state agencies, and that would be Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, various others, the Arts Board, any of the people that you appropriate money to. We would go to them just like we do on any other audit work, and hold them responsible for ensuring that the money is being spent as you have directed it to be spent. Now, one of the complications and one of the challenges for this audit work is that, as you well know, a lot of this money is then distributed to nonprofit organizations. And we do have authority to audit down to that level. But given the amount of money involved, the numbers of organizations involved, I just want to caution you that we cannot go to every organization and look at every dollar, but we will certainly do as much as we possibly can, because we understand that there is a very heightened sense of need for accountability and oversight, legislative oversight of this money. It was quite an extraordinary thing. I think we would all agree that the people of this state agreed to a tax increase for specific purposes. And I think there is a very high expectation that that money will be spent for those purposes. And so I think that's the public's expectation, that is yours. Obviously, the benchmark for us will be the actions of the legislature in appropriating that money. You will specify how you expect it to be used, and that will be the benchmark against which we will do our audit work.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles, and this is what we wanted to hear, that because it certainly is our goal, transparency is our goal, and to make sure that people can tell how the money was spent and that it was spent wisely. We wanted to understand the issue and the implications of the decisions. Is there anyone here that wants to testify about the plan, two plans a year, every other year cycle? I think that sounds very reasonable, and that from a work standpoint, that it's achievable. And so I think it's a good plan. Representative Haas.
Thank you. Mr. Nobles, is there any way to put the responsibility of the audit back to the person receiving the grant, and when they have their audit, specifically audit that grant and give a statement of whether those missions and criteria are obtained or not obtained, and then that audit being submitted back to us or to you?
Madam Chair,
Nobles.
Members, I think that's an excellent point, and it certainly would be our expectation that all of the people who are receiving money will have some requirement for reporting, whether it's in exactly an audit or not, but there should be some clear reporting back to the departments that are involved in administering these grants and ultimately to you as well as to how that money was spent. I think our role will be a verification of those reports. Many of the organizations that receive this money, as I said, are nonprofit organizations that have to be audited anyway for the breadth of their activities. And many of those activities would include money other than legacy fund money. So we will certainly look at those audit reports and try to build on those and not duplicate. But sometimes there are very specific questions that legislators have about how resources have been used. They're not covered in the normal financial audit that would be done by a CPA firm of a nonprofit organization. They would be looking much more broadly at financial statements and that sort of thing. So, but we will certainly build on that.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
When nonprofits are audited and they receive certain types of funds, it's not unusual for the auditor to say whether the criteria of that grant was met or it was not met, however, not just in the finances of it, but in the actual use of it. I think it's unwise to be giving grants to nonprofits that are not substantially self-audited. In another life, I used to ask the second question is, how much is your CEO paid? which is always interesting, and a lot of them didn't want to list it out, so then that took them out of the granting process, but it was always kind of interesting to ask that question also. Thank you.
But Madam Chair, I would just again emphasize that we would encourage as much rigorous auditing in addition to what we do. I think our experience, though, is a little bit colored by the fact that on occasion we have been asked to do special investigations of state grant money that went to certain nonprofit organizations. And when we did those investigations, we found some things that should not have occurred.
Exactly.
And should have, frankly, been called out by the audit firm, but were not. Those, I clearly think, were the exception. We don't do investigations unless there's good reason. So I think I don't want to overgeneralize and characterize that this is a widespread problem. But so we will, again, we will build on the audit work that is already there.
Thank you.
Representative Wiginius.
Well, thank you. Just a couple things. I totally agree with you about the high expectations, and that we, in this area, we just have to be better than usual because the public expects that. In our statute, we ask for every project to have a measurable outcome and for it to be measured and evaluated. It seems to me making sure that that happens for each project and gets up on our website gives us some basis to do the self-auditing that would be the basis of your work. Is that the way you see it?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Wiginius, yes. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of mechanisms of oversight that will be in play here, and certainly this committee and other legislative committees will be part of that, other legislative staff. And certainly the self-reporting and the transparency that you are requiring, I think, will enhance that. Again, what we can add to that is a level of verification as to those claims that are made. I do want to caution, though, that when we move from our financial audit work to questions about verification of outcomes, we're really moving over into our evaluation work. And that is not a part of what we are proposing to do here. I just want to be clear about that. I mean, I think a time will come when you will want us to do a program evaluation of some of these to, again, verify whether or not the claims about outcomes are, in fact, the case.
Representative Wiginius.
Thank you. You are going exactly where I think we need to go. I think we should be setting up now, beginning to figure out how we're going to do those program evaluations, that waiting a couple of years does not feel comfortable to me. Doing it next year is fine, but we need to set up a process for program evaluation. And one of the places that I see a need for it, or I'm going to see a need for it, is when we're doing restorations, we will be spending a ton of money on restorations. It's going to happen. There is an uncomfortably high failure rate in doing restorations. It's not just that easy as throwing out some seed. It just doesn't work that way. And it seems to me that when we're going to be spending millions upon millions upon tens of millions of dollars doing this, we have to have a way to do that very kind of program auditing and spot checking. We don't have that in place right now. And so, Madam Chair, I want us to get that in place. I think we're going to need it to meet those high expectations.
Thank you for that advice. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the request from the auditor seems quite reasonable here. But looking at this, this House File 3258 has to do with the auditor being paid. I guess a question for Mr. Nobles. Madam Chair and Mr. Nobles, I see here that House File 3258 has to do with your reimbursement, which I think sounds reasonable. Where would there be language for your workload, or can you just do that within the auditor's office?
Mr. Nobles.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative David. Yes, we clearly have authority and responsibility now to audit these funds. The Office of the Legislative Auditor has responsibility to audit all funds that you appropriate to state agencies and a variety of other organizations as well. So it really, the work, in a sense, grows out of our general responsibility. And I might, in response to your question, just kind of remind you of the scope of the work we do in our financial audit division. And it's very interesting, challenging work. And I certainly don't want to leave the impression that we feel overwhelmed by it, because but I do want you to understand that our resources are stretched. As I said, we're not going to ask for more money from the general fund to do this work, but I need you to understand that we have a lot of other responsibilities. Our work orders, Representative Davids, are many. We start every year with having to audit the state's financial statements. That's a statewide audit. It's required by law. It takes us approximately 6 months to complete the statewide audit. That audit is required for the state to receive credit ratings to its financial statements. After we complete that work, we do, again, a required audit under law, under federal law. We do an audit of all of the state's use of federal funds. So that's another audit that we do. And then we come to the individual audits that we do. We have responsibility to audit roughly 160 or so different entities of state government. We also audit a number of metropolitan agencies. We audit the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission, the Mosquito Control Commission, the Airports Commission, the State Fair. And so we have to work all of those audits in on some schedule. And so we typically do 30 or 40 of those individual entity type audits as we finish this other work. And that's where these audits of the legacy funds will fit. They will fit when we come to this additional audit work we do after we do the statewide audit, the federal audit. And so we're looking forward to it. But again, I appreciate the question, because these work orders fit within a scope of work that is quite challenging.
Well, Madam Chair, and just a question of process here. We have House File 3258. I would move this, or is this
the
state government committee?
It's state government. It's not ours.
Okay, so this is more informational.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Holmes.
Madam Chair, it would be helpful, since the bill is going to be up later this morning in Representative Kahn's committee, does the referral need to come back here?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But we wanted to have the discussion. We wanted to have the understanding of what's going to take place because of the legislation and how it was going to take place. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Nobles, I just want to give my little Clean Water Council speech. I haven't given it yet this year, and I would just encourage you.
It is a good day for it.
It is a good day for it. It's a nice day. Clean Water Council exists. All of the state agencies involved with clean water work are represented on the council, plus a number of interest groups from environmentalists to all the way up to farmers. And I would just encourage you to consider working with the council as you develop your audit for the clean water portion of these funds. And I would hope that your work would be reported to the Clean Water Council and discussed at that level.
Madam Chair, I would say in response to that, absolutely. We approach our work as auditors in a very collaborative way with various organizations, both in our financial audit work and in our program evaluation work. And we have certain protocols and procedures. We always have opening conferences with interested parties about what we're doing, what our schedule is, what our scope is,
people that are directly affected by our audits always receive an opportunity to review it in draft and comment on it. And as you've seen in many of our reports, entities that we name in our reports are given an opportunity to respond in writing, and that response is included within our report. So it is a very collaborative process. We often obviously have some criticisms or findings, but we certainly have a set of protocols and procedures that is very collaborative, and we will certainly be following your suggestion.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just to follow up, thank you for those remarks. I just, when you started your remarks, you mentioned that there was only one fund that had a go-to group, and I just wanted to make sure that the Clean Water Council was mentioned.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nobles. As I sit on this committee and hear all the discussion, we often have problems with the supplement and supplant discussion, and it just seems to me that through your auditing, it's a role that you could maybe perhaps help us with as a neutral party. As you discuss these things, of course, it's always the eye of the beholder of what's how those things fit in. And then as we progress through session, whether it be Environmental Finance Committee or the bonding bill or the LCCMR, and then and in this committee, and then how that all fits into supplement and supplant, and I would hope that maybe as a neutral party you could help us in that process of to see how that all fits together so that we're not in violation of the state constitution.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, and members, we have given that issue quite a bit of discussion in the office and exactly what would be our appropriate role with that. Obviously, we are not going to make constitutional judgments. We are certainly also going to pay, I think, appropriate deference to the judgments that you make as to whether or not the appropriations that you decide to make fulfill the constitutional requirements. But I think there is a role for us beyond that when we get into the details of exactly how the money was used. And it is going to be challenging. And again, we've had a good deal of discussions in the office about how we're going to approach these audits. And I think I should mention that it's our expectation that the money that you appropriate from the legacy funds will probably be commingled with a lot of other money on projects. And so exactly how we approach auditing legacy money is going to be a challenge when typically you're auditing an entity or you're auditing programs. You're not auditing just money that's sort of floating out there. You have to attach that money to something, and it's attached to people, organizations, and programs. So when you look at those programs and people and entities, and you're trying to find the legacy money to audit, there's probably going to be also game and fish money there. There's going to be federal money there. And so what you are going to get back as a report may be legacy money, but other money as well. And frankly, that's where I think we may get into this question of whether or not the legacy money supplanted or supplemented. But all of that depends on establishing some sort of a baseline of where were they before they got the legacy money. So there's some pretty complicated questions there. Again, this all sounds pretty daunting, but for us, we're excited about it. It's going to be challenging and interesting, so we're looking forward to it.
Mr. Soderbergh.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Nobles, and others, as we move forward here, we're going to be having to draw on the fund that's not a direct appropriation. And so it's important that we have communication from your office to the chair and to the committee as to how much is the expectation for the drawdown on the respective funds, because we can only spend the dollar once, and we need to keep an eye on now, because everything else will come through the committee, will directly appropriate, but now we're going to have a draw on the fund outside of this committee structure and your bill. So I just want people to be aware of the importance of having that communication and the like.
And Madam Chair, absolutely. And we have a fairly sophisticated, detailed, complex time reporting system in our office. We have this for a lot of purposes, but it will work, I think, for this purpose as well. And I go back, though, not to burden you with too much complexity, but I go back to the fact that we're going to send out a team of auditors, and they're going to be auditing a program, an entity, and again, there's going to be a mix of funds. And we understand that when we bill the hours to the legacy funds, we are going to have to somehow, within that time reporting, for that, let's say, one auditor's out there at DNR auditing a restoration project, let's say. But maybe there's more than just legacy fund a part of that project. The auditor is going to have to be mindful of when they are looking at legacy funds. They may have an eight-hour day there where they're looking at a variety of funds for that entity or that project. And we, and I think it is our responsibility, to segregate out that portion or part that relates to the legacy fund so that the fund is charged only for the hours that are focused on that work. Now, Madam Chair and members, there is a way, I guess, we could get away from this, and that is that we would just get a general fund appropriation for this work and not charge the funds. But I think there is some sense from people that the general fund should not always bear the burden for work that is the result of activities from other funds. And so the Game and Fish Fund, the Trunk Highway Fund, a variety of other funds bear their share of the work of not only the Office of the Legislative Auditor, but the Attorney General's Office and a variety of other state government functions. So I think we're following what is an established precedent here. But again, very mindful that this money is special in many ways. All public money is important, but I know that there are just a lot more eyes and expectations on this money because of the nature of how we are getting this money. And we want to meet that expectation as fully as possible.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Yeah. Madam Chairman and members, as soon as I saw this bill, I immediately went over to Mr. Shepherd and said, we need the standard clause that we put whenever we're automatically appropriating something that will make sure that we get reporting back. And he said, and he informed me that this bill is before our committee, not this committee, and so he'll prepare that amendment for the bill in our committee.
Right.
That will make sure that there's, and, you know, not that they wouldn't report without being told to, but we'll put it in the law so that it goes together.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to follow up on Representative Lilly's comment and acknowledge Mr. Nobles' response to it, because I think it may be easier to audit a project or many of the programs that we've appropriated money to where we're giving grants out, and you can go out and check out the grant. But we have appropriated in the Clean Water Fund money to an agency for additional staff. Primarily the appropriations were for staffing rather than for a grant. And I think particularly with the Department of Agriculture appropriations for the Clean Water Fund, looking at how those dollars and hours are appropriated and how the supplement or substitute question comes out, where we've put the money into people rather than into a project.
And Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Hansen. And you know, I might just say that this is going to be a 25-year experience for all of us. And we're going to start our audit work on this next year and start delivering our reports to you. And it can evolve. And if you want more, and if we're not addressing some of the questions that you have, I certainly want to have a conversation about that. And as we pick up on Representative Arguinius's idea that we may need to go beyond just the financial audit work into some evaluation work, certainly want to have that conversation as well. We want to be very responsive to your expectations and needs, the public's as well. And I might say that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is very open to citizens and interest groups coming to us and expressing their concerns and expectations. We do have mechanisms, if the need arises, to conduct very focused investigations. We do take those from members of the legislature as well as citizens as well. And so we have an audit schedule, but I just want to say, in addition to that, we do have some resources, very limited. I have two investigators that can take up some work that was not scheduled if you have some specific concerns. But as those specific concerns develop, I would hope we can roll some of those expectations and issues into a regular schedule of audits. But again, this is going to evolve, and we're going to start working on it and do the best we can. But I'm very open to your suggestions and even your criticisms of what we're doing if we're not meeting your expectations.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the work that the auditor is going to be doing on this, but when we look at this and the bill, what I see as we're determining where the costs are going to come from, and I think that you've planned it out really well, but I'm wondering, this is my own curiosity, having done this for years, do we have any clue what an average cost is going to be for this auditing? I know we're going to be doing it over a number of years, but first time around, certainly in the office, you've talked a little bit about what this may cost.
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, yes, we have done a fiscal note on this, and again, we've done this note based on our experience in other audit work, and our expectation is that these audits will, for example, on the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we estimate 900 hours of audit work. That would cost approximately $65,000. So that would be every other year. So we're talking a little more than, $30,000 a year, because these are going to be done every other year. For the smaller ones, Parks and Trails, for example, we're expecting about 500 hours of auditors' work. That's, by the way, a combination of staff auditors, audit managers, and a variety of other people. The Parks and Trails audit we expect to cost about $35,000 a year. Again, since they will only be done every other year, the funds will only bear half of that cost then. So they will get 1 year off, in other words. And then the cost for the other two funds would be similar. We're expecting the Clean Water Fund to be about a 900-hour audit, and the Arts and Cultural Heritage to also be close to the Parks and Trails, about 500 hours. So that's our estimate. But again, I think the complication that could arise is how deep and how broad we go to answer some of the questions that we've heard here today, and also the degree to which we get into some of the nonprofit organizations. It's fairly efficient and easy for us to audit organizations when all of the expenditures are being made through the state's accounting system. We can go online anytime and do some preliminary analysis and kind of target where we're going, because we know where the money is and where it's been spent and what it's been spent on, down to a level of detail. Once that money goes out the door from a state agency into a nonprofit organization, they have their own accounting system. And although they may have some reports back, we would want to go into a level of detail that would mean actually going to that organization. And so that's where it could be more time-consuming, and that's why we want to stay to the degree that we can at the agency and have an expectation that the agency is making sure that the grant money at the nonprofit level is being spent appropriately. But we'll see how that works out.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just quick do the totals for me? So you're thinking how much per year, then, just a round total that we'll be spending on auditing? I wrote things down kind of quick, but I don't know if I've got that.
It would be roughly $100,000.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
2559. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to move Representative Gardner's bill, and I'll move that it be House File 2559 be laid over for future consideration in our omnibus bill.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies for being late. I had 8:30 down and a 9-year-old to get to the bus at 8:15. But, Madam Chair, I didn't really have any grand plans or secret objective to slip this into something larger bill. I thought maybe we could just use this as a chance to really start a conversation for the future about the sustainability of a lot of our water systems in the state. Not too many people know, but in 2008, I authored legislation requiring public water suppliers for cities over 1,000 people to have a conservation rate structure. That pretty much said that if you use more, you pay more at a higher rate, and it was up to the cities to decide where those thresholds were. We had that in place in the city where I live, in Shoreview, for about 20 years, and has been very successful. Our wells have never run dry during bad times, so it seemed to be a prudent measure. That caused me to really look at how rates are managed elsewhere in the state on other issues, particularly to see if our water systems are not only charging rates that are sufficient enough to cover their operating costs so that they're not subsidizing water from other parts of their budget, but to see if they're setting enough money aside in reserves in order to maintain their water system when things go awry. I was actually happy to go to a training session last summer put on by the Minnesota Rural Water Association, where they had a noted rate-setting expert come. And he was actually talking about how to implement the conservation rate structure, but it also caused a lot of those rural cities in particular to review their overall rate structures to make sure that they were able to sustain their water systems over time. I've had conversations with the folks at the Public Facilities Authority, and was pleased to see that they have a very well-run system, in my opinion, and they actually do ask cities when they apply for funding to say how they're planning to pay for the funding for the bond. So that includes looking at the rates to make sure that they can actually sustain what they're doing. There is often some local pressure on city councils, for example, or these local water utility commissions to lower rates and not take the tough decision to actually put rates where they need to be to maintain the infrastructure. And that's part of the goal of the bill, is to have some statewide, where we would be the heavy in a sense, saying you really need to have an operating ratio of 1.0, which means that your operating revenue has to equal your operating costs. Ideally, you'd like to have something like a ratio of about 1.15 or a little bit less than that to maintain enough money in your reserve fund, and then also not to use your water rates as a revenue center to use for other purposes, which has been the case in years past, not so much now. Excuse me, I should turn my phone off so I don't mess up your PA system. In any case, the folks at the PFA would be available just to talk about the work that they are doing to make sure that the cities are keeping the rates where they need to be. My goal with the legislation in part in Section 1 is actually to help keep a lot of cities from ending up having to ask for financial assistance from the state and federal governments in the first place by having rates that essentially keep revenue where it needs to be to maintain their systems. But if it's okay, if someone from PFA, they said they'd be available just to talk about what they require of cities when they do get give out financial assistance.
Representative, what about non areas where there's non-cities, but there's growth in rural townships that's way over 1,000, and they're putting in new water supplies. Would this treat them as cities?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am using the word city a little bit too loosely, I'm afraid. The phrase that we've used here is public water supplier.
Okay.
So that could include a town, too.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm with the Public Facilities Authority. I can just briefly tell you and be happy to answer any questions, but all of the applicants that come to us for our water financing programs, Clean Water Revolving Fund, Drinking Water Revolving Fund, we are, our statutes and rules require that we ensure they have dedicated revenues that are sufficient to cover the debt service on our loan and the operation and maintenance costs of their system. And so that's a standard part of the review that our loan officers do on all applicants, and we don't make a loan until that we know that those dedicated revenues are in place. In terms of revenues for future replacement, the operation and maintenance costs that we're looking at always would have a what's called an equipment replacement fund, a reserve, or a reserve for short-lived assets, the kind of pumps and things that would tend to be need to be replaced more often than the major components of the system. And so that's a part of that O&M cost that we're looking at. The long-term replacement costs, we do have, when the state uses the WIF program, the Wastewater Infrastructure Fund, which is the grants or deferred loans that are based on an affordability factor, supplemental assistance when a community can't afford to just borrow the cost of the project through the revolving funds. That program does have a requirement that they put aside 50 cents per 1,000 gallons of flow for that long-term replacement. We monitor that. They have to document that money is being set aside each year. We monitor audits for all of our borrowers, and for WIF recipients, we're looking at that they have that replacement fund in place. So that's how we're dealing with that, the long-term replacement.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Mr. Freeman, my question is, how would this proposed legislation impact what you do, and is it needed?
Mr. Freeman.
With respect to the Section 2 that relates specifically to the Public Facilities Authority, I don't think it would really change the way we're operating. The first section of the bill would apply the requirements to all systems on an ongoing basis. So that's a little different. But in terms of when they come to us to apply for money, I don't think there would be a change in how we do that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Freeman, do we need this legislation, do you think?
Freeman.
In our experience, the issue of across the board our public water suppliers charging enough to operate and maintain their systems, I think probably municipalities in the state have come a long way in the past, I don't know how many years. I'm sure that I think in the past you could maybe find a lot of cases where cities were significantly underfunding their systems, and then tending to look for, come to you or look for grants, free money in one way or another, to sort of offset the fact that they weren't charging enough. I think cities have come a long way and are much more sophisticated in how they manage their finances. And so I don't see that as a significant issue anymore. I'm sure there are a few examples out there you might be able to find, but eventually they're going to have to make some kind of capital improvement, and when they do that, they're probably going to come either to us or to one of the other funders, USDA Rural Development being another one of the major funders, and we're all going to at that point require that they raise rates to fund the system from that point on.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. When you said you're going to come to you or another funder and you're going to say raise rates from this point on, I think Representative Gardner is getting at the bigger picture issue of what we need to do in wastewater in this state. And at a previous meeting, I asked Mr. Kuhlman if he would figure out for all of us what the aggregate need is out there, because we have made guesstimates of that, and it is huge. I think he's working on that. Do you know when you will have that ready for us?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Bouguinius, we have talked about that. The issue is, of course, that the PFA, we're only funding some portion of the total capital projects for water infrastructure that happens in a given year. We know what other funders are doing for the most part, but what we don't really have a handle on is how much capital construction work is happening that cities are financing on their own privately through the going directly to the bond market and or funding it through cash reserves or that kind of thing. So the what the total picture is for that capital construction, we can only sort of estimate and guess at. And to do, I think, what you're talking about, we sort of have to get a sense of that larger picture. We've talked a little bit about this summer having some conversations with the, I forget the association's name, but financial advisors that work in the state, that work with municipalities, and would help them bring bonds to the private market directly to kind of get a better handle on what's the overall scope. I'm not sure how to sort of make sense of all that and bring you some sort of overall financial plan that I think you're looking for. I'm not sure how that's going to be able to proceed.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Bouguinius, I should mention too that this bill deals with drinking water, but Representative Scalzi has a similar bill to help wastewater systems make sure they're charging rates to not only maintain their operating costs. She has another bill that would require them to create enterprise funds so that they set aside money for future maintenance. But certainly the scope of what you're talking about is, I'm interested in finding that out as well. Representative Scalzi, I don't think, is coming forward with that legislation this year. She's heard from stakeholders, and there's a vigorous discussion going on, and she and I are talking about what we would do next year to ensure the sustainability of both wastewater and drinking water systems.
Good. Discussion is always good, Representative Gardner. And now Mr. Freeman, your remarks seem to bring up more people that want to testify. Mr. Coleman?
Madam Chair, I'll just be real brief trying to respond to Representative Genius. What I would like to do before next session is just try to put together kind of the big picture, all the variables, all the actors. I've already got commitment from the Minnesota Association of Municipal Finance, which are the bond councils, financial advisors, and underwriters in the state, because they want to participate in those discussions as well. as well as like the League of Cities and Minnesota River Water and stuff. And may not be an exact plan. Here's what needs to be done, but here's all the issues, problems. Give things to chew on, give us some good background information, and we hope to have that ready before January.
Oh, that's terrific.
Very good. Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, Ms. Hubbard.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Wanted to make a couple of brief comments on this, a couple of which are reflected by the comments you just heard from the Public Facilities Authority. The municipal water utilities for public water supplies in Minnesota are being very responsibly run right now. There may be some that think that they won't have to have a good water rate when they try to upgrade their system. They're wrong. It's an uneducated belief, if there's someone you've talked to that thinks that, because regardless of where they go, they are going to have to catch up to modern technology, modern systems, and rates to support those systems. And in fact, there's a fairly complex system before the project even is eligible to be considered for funding, of studying the pricing structure that would be necessary to make sure they can afford it and look at what would be involved. And once a project is funded by any of these funders, there's an annual audit to make sure they're keeping the rates at a sustainable level to keep the utility flush. So no pun intended. I would also add that there are some concerns raised by this language. To start with, there's already a requirement. If you read the existing language on the bill in subdivision 3B, lines 1 through 1-7, up till the new language starts at the end of 1-8, we are already, regardless of charter restrictions, shall set our rates as nearly as possible proportionate to the cost of furnishing the service. It's already a requirement in law. Further in this subdivision, in sections subdivision 3I and J, we also are required to keep all excess monies collected within the utility, and we are further empowered to use that to pay down debt or for other infrastructure costs. So statute already both allows and requires some of the things in here. Our concerns are that it raises some confusion about how those things should be applied. Because this is so strictly tied to the setting of rates, we really feel that it raises a number of concerns. We, first of all, have rates. The people paying rates fluctuate very dramatically in any given community at any given time. Businesses shut down. We've had cities over the last couple of years that have had a major business shutdown that's 25% of the customer base of their local water utility. Now they are hoping that the business is only shut down over the winter or for a couple months, but does that mean that over that time they need to redo their rate structure, raise the rates on all existing users high enough to cover that temporary downing of a business, or do they use some other fund sources to temporarily patch that funding need, make the change only if it becomes clear it's a long-term situation? We also have a number of funding mechanisms that are not fees or charges that are used to finance our utilities. We have special assessments. We have charges authorized in statute to abutting property owners that are not on the system, but are on an abutting property that benefits in property value from being accessible to the system. We have local debt and bonds that we do at the local level that are not a fee. So there are a number of other mechanisms that we're concerned, since this says it has to be through the charges collected, could be put at risk as a viable funding source and believe me, we have people who are happy to challenge any funding source we come up with for our local utilities. So we've been working with the author on how to address that. I do think it's the right message to send, that we do have to make sure our utility rates are set at an adequate level. We work very hard through our League of Minnesota Cities educational system, through our insurance trust folks as well for loss prevention, and with Rural Water Association to get the word out really broadly statewide. Ruth can talk more on that, but it's something we work very hard to make sure our cities are doing well, and we believe that as best we know that it continues to be a very well run system. Minnesota is actually well known for how well our municipal utilities operate. Madam Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hubbard. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. The Minnesota Rural Water Association is a technical assistance provider. We have a staff of 18 that travels the state of Minnesota with on-site technical assistance to municipal systems, rural water, wastewater systems, and also into townships. We deal with water rate issues, wastewater rate issues daily. We also train water and wastewater operators for their certification hours and the governing officials in setting the rates for those systems. Our goal to work with those systems, both water and wastewater, is to make those systems sustainable, and that is with adequate rates, other fees that may be availability charges, adequate information on assessment policies that may be put in place, building adequate reserve accounts. As Representative Gartner said, we did have a training session that we brought a professional speaker in last October that he did attend that addressed setting water rates along with the new water conservation rules. So our goal is to educate those individuals that they need to prepare themselves for those system improvements, because if they don't have the adequate rates that are in place now, when they get to either the PFA to do their system improvement financing or to rural development, those rates will have to be in place. The goal of those improvements is they're going to have a loan, and they need to have the adequate ability to repay that loan. So with that construction in mind, if they haven't done it now, they're going to be doing it in the very near future. And I believe that municipalities need to have the flexibility, whether it's with the water rates assessments or SAC and WAC charges or whatever fees or assessments need to be in place for the sustainability of that system, that those systems have that flexibility. And we would love to work with Representative Gardner over this next year to make sure that the sustainability of those systems is number one in Minnesota. As Craig Johnson said, Minnesota is very well known in the nation for their sustainability of water and wastewater systems, and we hope to be a part of being able to maintain that. Thank you so much. Representative Gardner, you have more work to do, and we are strongly behind your efforts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have accomplished my objective, which is to have a conversation, to have a little bit of oversight, to see where we are with our state agencies. And just generally speaking, in closing, I would say that, like so many other things in education, healthcare, the environment, Minnesota, I think, is actually far ahead of a lot of other states in how we manage our utilities. And so the legislation has helped us just have this conversation to see where we're at, and we'll see where we go next year.
Thank you. This is a growing conversation in my district also because of the need for new water and wastewater systems or hookups. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
The main event.
Can't wait for this one. Don't forget your picture.
We've been anticipating it for so long.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Litchfield Opera House a little bit. You've seen the picture down there. It was built in 1900 in Litchfield. It's on the National Registry of Historic Sites. It was a site of operas, of Chautauqua presentations. The first cooperative electrical Light Cooperative in the state of Minnesota was formed at a meeting in that building. So it's a historic building. It's been city-owned. It's transitioned through various uses over the years, most recently as the city hall offices for Litchfield. It developed a mold problem, and they moved out, and there was a great effort by the city of Litchfield to dismantle, tear down, obliterate the Opera House, where as a child I met Santa Claus. So I was certainly opposed to this destruction. And it was placed on the list of Minnesota's most endangered structures, number four on the list. And in the midst of the struggle to save the Opera House, the Litchfield editor of the newspaper was he was on the tear it down side. There's one city councilwoman and I were trying to protect the Opera House. And I'll just read a brief little ditty that I wrote for the newspaper on this. Every lich down in Litchfield liked old buildings a lot, but the Grinch who lived in West Litch did not. The Grinch hated old buildings. Tear them all down, he said. We need them no more. The builders are dead. We need not the red courthouse, he snapped. The depot is gone. The old library is crap. And what of downtown? Old structures of brick. Demolish them all before I get sick. The Duchess of 4th Street was fairly aghast. These buildings are special. We must make them last. We can't build them up once they are down. This is our history, the heart of our town. The Grinch snarled at Duchess, his eyes burning bright, and get that darn opera house out of my sight. It's an ugly old building, the walls full of mold, and Santa never went there, whatever I'm told. It's not worth the money, and it has no use. Smash every brick so we've no more to lose. The Duchess turned pale. She said, quiet as a mouse, you want to destroy our dear opera house? It goes on.
We've noticed.
But basically, it has been transitioned to a nonprofit now. The city of Litchfield sold it to a nonprofit. They are attempting to restore the building to its original grandeur, and have done remarkable work so far. They have gutted the inside. They're restoring the stage, the spiral staircases. It's really going to be a fantastic building when they finally get it done. But the immediate problem is this. By the way, when they tore out the walls, they found one spot of mold that big, just a little spot. They've taken care of all of that. The immediate problem is the outside. When the city fixed the roof 10, 15 years ago and also tuck pointed the outside. However, in the tuck pointing, they filled the cracks with a hard mortar or cement. Apparently, and engineers, architects could explain this better, it's not good to have the filler, the mortar, harder than the brick, because now the bricks are starting to crack and fall apart. They've got to go in there and once again take out the mortar and redo it. This is very important. That's what the monetary request is to do, is to fix the outside to maintain the integrity of it so that they can continue doing what they're doing on the inside. So it's going to be a beautiful structure. We just need to get some more funding to make sure that outside remains intact. And so that's what it is.
Representative Erdahl, I see that by the amount requested in House File 2632, you're asking for $600,000 from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Has the nonprofit that you are here speaking on their behalf of submitted applications for grants from the Arts Board and or the Historical Board?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And have they received them?
Have what?
Have they received any?
They have received some smaller grants. They have put in a grant, I believe, Mr. Keller can correct me if I'm wrong. I think I know they have put in a grant now to the State Historical Society for a substantial amount, I believe around $300,000.
And how about to the Arts Board?
I think it just went, it's to the Historical Society, not to the Arts Board.
Do you think that a retired teacher writer could be putting any elbow grease and substantial work into the building?
I actually did help to remove the carpeting. So not a lot of work, but I have put in a little time into it. There are some people who are literally donating their full time. You know, some retired people who are working every day in the Opera House trying to fix stuff. And there's ongoing fundraising that they're doing. They're trying to get, you know, other monies out there. But a real lot of sweat equity has gone into this.
Maybe it's time to, instead of writing poetry to the newspaper, you should write another letter to the Santa Claus.
Thank you.
You met Santa Claus there, so that's a warm memory.
Yes.
I bet. Maybe the Santa would be feel good about that building.
Maybe Mrs. Santa Claus dressed in red and white or something.
That could be true. Thank you for telling us again about the Litchfield Opera House and refreshing our mind memories about it. And I think that the substance of your poem said it too. The Duchess on the Main Street. And she deserves something.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davis.
Well, Madam Chair, I think this is a very fine project. But just one question for the author of the bill is, does Litchfield store any sheet music in here?
I believe that Jenny Lynn sang there.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair.
The question, Representative Davis, is could Litchfield store?
Madam Chair, we may have to move some.
I will say that the whole Litchfield downtown is a historic district, the buildings.
So there would be a big hole if it was not restored.
Yes, there would.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I would like to come back to you with, I believe, a final version of our legislative guide for your consideration and hopeful adoption. So to get the ball rolling, I guess I would like to move the February 16 draft number 4 of the legislative guide to get it before the committee for adoption.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And over the course of the last month, since I was last before you, I have worked with members from both sides of the aisle, staff from both sides of the aisle, and nonpartisan staff to address some of the issues that came up. I think actually most of the issues that came up in conversations here in the committee and elsewhere. Regarding some of the language in the previous version, draft 4 of the guide. So in order to address that language, I have an amendment that I would like to move. It is labeled 3/23/2010 at 3:57 p.m. MS/HRD. And I would like to move this amendment to the legislative guide.
And we are working also with the document that's in your book, Representative Morgan, first reference.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing I would like to point out, on lines 13 and 14 of the amendment, that language should be underlined. That is new language. I don't want to mislead folks that we're just striking from that previous bulleted point. We are striking the current language from that previous bulleted point, and we are adding new language. So,
starting with prairies on 13 and ending with populations on 14?
That all should be underscored as new language, yes, Madam Chair. And I won't go through all of the language. I'll certainly answer any questions that people have. But again, as I said earlier, this is an attempt. And again, I appreciate the input from members on both sides of the aisle and staff on both sides of the aisle to address some of the issues. Some folks had concerns that we were drifting away from the constitutional language, and that was completely not intended. And we think some of the language changes here reflect our desire to stay true to the constitutional language that was passed by the voters. And these changes, I think, reflect that. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has about this amendment before we vote to amend the guide.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Morgan, I appreciate your hard and diligent work on a lot of complicated issues. I just had one question, and that's on the amendment on the third item where it's related to the sixth bullet. I guess we should have numbered our bullets. It's hard to track it all through. And it's about the interpretation of striking, including parks and trails. I have no problem with saying it's not our intent to use this on parks that have picnic shelters and bike trails and the things that are really designed for recreational use. What I'm envisioning is the Three Rivers Park System, which manages...
Excuse me, just a minute. Okay, sorry. Representative Loeffler, where
I'm on the amendment, and if you look at the third item where it says page 2 and it amends the sixth bulleted item, and there's a striking that includes parks and trails. I don't have any problem with this because I don't think we intended this to be used on recreational parks. But Three Rivers Parks District, I think, has tens of thousands of acres in, I think, 8 or 9 counties. I'm not even sure how many they're in right now. And some of those are really what we would call scientific and natural areas in other parts of the state. But they are labeled a park, because that's the term anyone in this metro part of the area calls anything that doesn't have a commercial or residential building on. And so that you may have what's labeled by name a park, but it has a very definite wilderness area of large, large, large size in which there may be a major purpose in serving habitat needs that may have something that needs restoration or attention, and I'm just not quite sure how to address that because I honor the intent. I just think that some people are very literal interpreting our actions, and I wouldn't want this to prevent a hunting and rec area, a very natural area, from qualifying simply because of a different use of word in a different part of the state. And maybe we're going to have to rename those scientific natural areas. I don't know what the implications of that would be.
Representative Morgan.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Representative Loeffler, very good point. There had been some concerns expressed. Clearly in our goals adopted last year, and I think it's reflected in the general principles in the first section of the guide that we hope that money can be used in multiple ways, that we can, to the extent possible, break down some of the silos between the funds, and that efforts should be made to look into ways that can work. And I think that's still accounted for in the language of the guide. There was some sensitivity expressed to specific references within the Outdoor Heritage Fund portion to funding parks and trails, and the idea that there is a separate
fund for funding parks and trails. And I think this was an effort to address that. However, if you look down into the into the next section of the amendment, we specifically say that scientific natural areas that do contain prairies, forests, wetlands, and other habitat should be protected, restored, and enhanced. So I think that we're trying to account for all of those things that you said there, but in language that is more consistent with the language in the Constitution.
Just follow up, Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I think we're both going towards the same goal, without a doubt. I just, because I don't serve on the Environment Committee and I've learned a lot here, I just don't know if scientific and natural areas is in a specific designation that's only given in certain to certain ownership and certain plans. And so what I was just describing, which is really wild territory not used for recreation except perhaps for hunting, would qualify, or if we'd have to reclassify it, and if that would have other implications that I don't totally understand.
Representative Kahn.
Possibly looking at those two bullet points together, or way to fix it would be at the scientific and natural areas, add the language you took out above, and park and natural areas. Because the most egregious example of excluding parks is the Mississippi River Flyway, which goes through the city of Minneapolis as a park, goes through the whole Three Rivers system as part of a park, is one of the major flyways in the country and one of the four major flyways in the world. If that's not something that's it's important to take care of through every fund that we have in it, nothing in the state is. That's just being the absolutely major migration rate that we deal with. So I think I understand what Representative Loeffler is concerned with, but having written this, if that had been written this way originally, it may be all right, but specifically striking the word park wherever it appears is, I think, a move in the wrong direction. And so I understand the kind of linking of parks and trails, the concerns that people have about what you're going to do with that, but I think if we put that scientific and natural in the amendment you proposed on the page, on the lines 29 and 30, if you add scientific and natural areas and park/natural areas, or add the language where these may occur or where these may occur in parks, would be all right. Because it's a different concept. The scientific and natural areas is a specific separate budget line.
Yeah.
It doesn't include the Mississippi River Flyway, is not included in scientific natural areas. And I would say if there's anything in the state that it's important to protect, that is. So I would add that language back. In other words, I'm saying I don't think you need to add the parks and trails, which was a fly point, but I think you need to add back to the change there, the scientific and natural areas. You need to add the and park natural areas containing in that line. You need to add that back.
Representative Houston.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just observe we do read all bullet points, and if you look at the one just before, prairies, wetlands, forests, and habitats may be restored on or enhanced on existing public property. I mean, if you just say on existing public property, right, you do have a comprehensive term there. And that applies to, I would think, all of the bullet points.
I agree.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I don't think any language in this guide is excluding or exclusive of any of the concerns that have just been expressed. I think the intent here is to remove some language that has caused some particular concerns among stakeholders and members of this table. And I think we're talking about one fund here. We're talking about the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And I think that the The intent of the committee is pretty clear in our investment goals passed last time and in the rest of this, that these are things that should be considered. So.
Representative Connolly.
The language that you're taking out specifically takes that part. And I really have problems with doing that.
Okay.
I do, because scientific and natural, and then the fact that you had to put back in that scientific and natural areas containing those things, that means you have to put in also, put back in that also and parks containing those things. Because we're looking at a very specific, prairies, forests, wetlands, and other habitats. And the fact is that you feel it, you know, I'm really concerned that you feel it necessary to meet those concerns by taking out parks. When a major wildlife habitat part is in parks.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I too want to thank Representative Morgan for his work on this. But to Representative Kahn's point on this sixth bulleted item, if you read that, it, you know, you're taking out including parks and trails, but they're already included because they're public property.
Public property.
I know, but so is the Chairman, Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
But then so are scientific and natural. When you take out, specifically take out parks and trails and then put something back, then it's specifically, you're specifically excluding that. Then scientific and natural areas are also public property. Then you don't need that whole bullet at all. But for some reason we think we need to cover scientific and natural areas, and I'm saying you need to cover parks. Because that's what scientific, what we call scientific and natural areas when they're under the control of DNR, we call parks when they're under the control of the metropolitan agencies, which happen to have the most important wildlife management area in this, the only wildlife management area in the state, I would say, that is internationally recognized. And to not specifically protect that is, you know, a mistake.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Houseman, I spoke earlier.
I think one of the pieces of clarity that we need is that when I look at the language scientific and natural areas, I am also looking at perspective pieces. And you're talking about things we already own. So there is this other nuance here in the language. I understand it's a term of art, but
it's not a term of art. It's defined in the statutes, I believe.
What?
Scientific and natural.
No, I understand. I agree with that. But we have a list of scientific and proposed scientific and natural areas where there's a huge backlog. Some of them are prairies, forests, wetlands that we don't own yet. And you're talking about things that we already own. That's the nuance that I'm trying to bring out here. I don't know the answer to the question. I'm just saying that that's what a difference I see.
Well,
Representative,
I don't care then if we amend the definition of what scientific and natural areas are. But I don't you know, we could even just say including internationally recognized phylums would be fine with me. But the point is that we've taken
that would be
you know, but the point is that we've taken parks out, and the most and one of the most important part of this happens to be in something that's called a park.
Representative Dinius.
Perhaps adding the language scientific and natural areas and known flyways might solve the problem? Is that, would that solve the problem?
That would certainly solve one that I'm aware of, which is, I think, a very major one.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, I think that solves the problem of the Mississippi flyway. Yes. I don't think it solves the problem of Three Rivers, which might in Wright County own 5,000 pieces, acres of land that are basically wild and natural areas owned and maintained for habitat purposes, and but are labeled, because of our convention of labeling, park. They're not designated by the statutory definition of scientific and natural area. And so that's So it solves one of the issues, and I like add known flyways because I think that is a dynamic, just like we have these natural corridor plans, acknowledging flyways I think is important. But I think it still is that nomenclature difference where scientific and natural areas is defined in statute as a particular thing, and yet we have tracks that are exactly the same, managed for the exact same purpose, that happen to not be fall under that designation just because of their ownership or because of historical use of terms.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think what's going on here is if we look on the lines 18 and 19 on the amendment, we're talking about restoration and enhancement. And I believe what Representative Morgan has tried to do is to provide some comfort here so that we can get to some consensus and hopefully get the guide adopted. And the controversy is that there are some stakeholders who don't want to spend any money on parks and trails from other funds because they feel that the Parks and Trails Fund should take care of that. I believe what the amendment, what this amendment does is it says, and again, we're talking about restoration and enhancement, so we're not talking about buying property that's already public property. We're talking about restoring and enhancing. So if there is a wetland on a park somewhere that could be restored or needs enhancement, that dollars could be used for that, whether it's a park, a scientific and natural area that has specific meaning. And I think that what Representative Morgan is trying to do here is to provide the inclusivity without providing something that people could react to negatively. And I think, Representative Kahn, that the way that 18 and 19 are written, it allows for the use of the fund for wetland, prairie, forest, or habitat restoration and enhancement on a public park. Mm-hmm. And it's broad enough to do that. And I think that people are content with that, recognizing what the language says. And it's not designed to exclude anybody. It is actually designed to be inclusive, but silent.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I think that the way to go would be to make sure that the definition, you don't have to add back parks and trails if that's a black point in that first one. But I think in the page 2 one, in the principles, I think that we want to add back the fact that people seem to be, that scientific and natural areas is a broader definition than the statutory definition of scientific and natural areas. So I think the combination of adding nationally and internationally recognized flyways, and there are, I have a map of all of these in there, to the definition of, so line 29 would read, scientific and natural areas, including nationally and internationally recognized flyways, and the language that Representative Loeffler got, you know, and sections, and public property that includes, you had some good words that gave a big, that gave what should be a good definition of a natural area, certainly, but is
public,
you know.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, it might have been public property owned primarily for habitat purposes.
Yes. Yeah. I think that gets away from the sense that we're using it to build a trail or we're using it to put picnic shelters in parks, but we're doing exactly what that fund is intended to do. And I think just making sure that term of art includes everything that we kind of recognize as a natural area as opposed to a park, but it just doesn't have to fall into the statutory definition of SNA.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morgan, just wondering, on page 2, line 12 of the amendments, can the Parks and Trails Fund be used for ATVs and snowmobiles?
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, the particular reference you're speaking to in this amendment was from the Outdoor Heritage Fund section.
So that is why we struck all of those references, because we felt that those were inappropriate in the Outdoor Heritage Fund section. I don't know what all the laws are governing parks and trails. This committee, in its appropriation from the Parks and Trails Fund, gave authority to a variety of agencies to distribute those funds and solicit grants for the use of those funds. And this guide in no way is meant to undermine or direct how those agencies chose or will choose to distribute those funds.
Representative Morgan? When did we start this project?
Madam Chair, we began this project last August.
I'm sure if that was 10 AD.
And Representative Morgan, this is, and then we had testimony, and if my memory serves, we closed public testimony, written and oral, on the 31st of December.
That is my recollection as well.
But then in January and February and March, we also had additional testimony and changes. And this is the third meeting where we've had the fourth draft up for final vote. Is that correct?
I believe people are starting not to believe us anymore when we say final action on this legislative guide.
No one Chair. Is to leave this table until we reach a solution.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that any changes in this draft would be unconstitutional under the clause of cruel and unusual punishment. And I would suggest that we vote on it. Representative Morgan has done yeoman's work on this, and there will be another time, another place to make changes that folks want. But if there's any I believe that if there's any changes on this language, that we'll have to have draft five, and that would be unconstitutional.
I agree.
Representative Collins.
Madam Chairman, did anyone raise the point that scientific and natural area is not a term of art, but a specific statutory term that's used?
Representative Morgan, Representative Haas, Representative Wagenius, in your deliberations over the last month, has this come up? Representative Wagenius.
Well, until we had this conversation and made it a statutory thing in our conversation, I would have assumed that it was something identified as a scientific and natural area, a proposed one. So if you're going to change the language now that you've had this conversation, and stated on the record that it is a statutory definition, not a term of art. I thought of it as a term of art.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you'd have to say scientific and natural areas and proposed scientific and natural areas. But I prefer to think of it as a term of art.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, you know, even if you add the language in the broadest sense of this term, I mean, the problem is that you're specifically excluding, you know, and I think we've seen very unequal expenditures from that fund. But you're specifically excluding what are some of the most important natural areas for wildlife in the state by these changes in language. And I don't care how many times it's gone through, unless someone can explain how you're not doing that, I really don't think this should go through as it is.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I respectfully disagree with Representative Kahn. I don't think we're excluding. I think this is a legislative guide, and it is designed to provide a framework for this committee and those who will come before this committee to make recommendations on expenditures, appropriations from these funds. I think it is an important step towards our next step, which will be consideration of the recommendations for this year's appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We don't have any appropriations, I believe, that we will be making in the other three funds this year. But certainly we will be in the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And I think this will help provide a framework around which we can make some decisions. But it is a guide. It is not set in stone. I think it is a very useful tool. It will be a very useful tool once we've adopted it.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I appreciate your work too, Representative Morgan. Just to clarify, to give me some comfort, so on 18, lines 18 and 19, so a trail and park, in your mind and your vision, would be considered public property.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, anything that is in the public domain, anything that the public owns, would be public property.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Guinness.
And just to reemphasize, because I do think we should go forward with this and do it now, scientific and natural areas are in statute. They're also a term of art. So with that, I think we should just go ahead.
Well, Representative Haas.
Thank you. I was going to make a suggestion, but I hate to run in contradiction to the Constitution, you know.
or the law.
AD or anybody bigger than I am. But could we maybe say natural areas, including scientific and natural areas, or, you know.
Yeah.
Representative Haas.
That's it? Yeah, I would so amend that we do natural areas inclusive of scientific and natural areas containing prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitats.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I don't like to do these things on the fly.
Would that be in terms of ducks, geese, or us?
The ducks and geese would definitely appreciate that change.
So I'm going to remain neutral and leave it to the will of the committee.
I would still amend.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative David.
I would respectfully speak against the amendment simply because we have what I consider a deal, and any changes made, which can be debated ad nauseum at a future date. I would speak against the amendment because you're going to lose this side of the table real fast if it passes.
Representative Kahn.
Well, just explain why that phrase, that when we've had every explanation that it's supposed to be included in public areas, that we don't want to include trail construction, the kind of things that we don't want it, that we've had this sense that scientific and natural areas are an expanded term, that specifically doing this artful way of it, making sure that people understand that. Can you explain why that's a deal breaker?
Madam Chair, no, I can't, and that's why I would need more testimony on the issue itself. I'm set to support this guide as it is now, and I'm sure that we'll have bills or motions to change it down the road, because I would certainly want to talk to the various constituencies that may have some problem with this, and I don't know if there are any. I don't know. That's the whole point, is I don't know. And so I think Representative Morgan has done a great job working with various groups, and it hasn't been easy. And I just really don't want to upset that apple cart right now. And maybe for no good reason, Representative Kahn, I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I don't understand the reasoning, but I respect your opinion. I withdraw my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Haas. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the conversation that continues around this legislative guide. I'm sure that, as Representative Davids mentioned, that conversation will continue. But I think for right now, this gives us a good framework. I hope we will adopt this amendment. I hope we will adopt this guide and move forward with that framework as we consider the next round of appropriations from the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council.
Representative Morgan renews his motion to adopt amendment MSHRD 3:57 p.m. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion to adopt the legislative guide as amended.
Draft.
Draft 4. Thank you.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee.
Representative Wagenius's bill will be held over for the same time that we do Representative Hansen's bill, and there are two or three others coming. This meeting is adjourned.